Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Bralton. I'm laughing at you because you always start with, hey there.
Hey there.
Hey there. Every time, and it makes me laugh every time. Sorry.
That's his thing.
I know. I'm fine with it. It's just I look forward to it now because it gives me a little smile at the beginning of our podcast.
And anyway. Who are you?
Hey there. I'm John Steinbecker.
It's good to be back with you after an extra week in between episodes this time around. Hope you didn't miss us too much. A busy episode coming up. We'll talk with Michael Cerami from BleacherNation.com, a Cubs fan website that does some great work. We'll talk to Michael about the Cubs. As we talk here on Tuesday morning, the Cubs are trailing 2-0 in the National League Championship Series, playing Game 3 tonight against the L.A. Dodgers at Wrigley Field. We'll preview that with Michael coming up here a little bit later in the episode. We'll also have some controversy for you coming up a little bit later on.
Baseball related.
It is baseball related indeed. Cork controversy. We'll have that for you just ahead. And we'll also have our status update as always. That'll wrap things up on the bandwagon. But first, news of the week. And Lisa Bralt, what's going on with the U.S. men's national soccer team?
I don't know. I have so many thoughts on not just the topic of them, but the way U.S. soccer in general is being talked about and discussed. First of all, for those of you who don't know, the U.S. men's national team is not going to the World Cup in Russia next year, and it is all their own fault. They completely beat themselves. Mm-hmm. They had a chance. I mean, really, when I was watching the game the other night where they were playing Trinidad and Tobago, all they had to do, I can't even remember what the calculus was for them, but they didn't. All they had to do was, like, win it or maybe even tie it.
I think tie would have done it.
Yeah, And I'm watching the game, and you know, everybody who's watching, who cares about soccer, is watching the game and thinking to themselves, "All right, cool, World Cup next year, it's gonna rock." You know, we got this. And then all of a sudden, we did not got this. We so not got it.
Yeah, the old own goal is never a good start to a game.
You know, again, it's sort of like you know, you feel a lot for the person to whom that has happened.
Yeah.
But then you also have to ask the question, why was that guy in the lineup in the first place, for lots of reasons that I won't even go into. Anyway, needless to say, they lost the game to Trinidad and Tobago. Nothing against them. I mean, and I don't even think Trinidad and Tobago were playing for anything but spoiler.
No, they weren't. They weren't. They finished last in the group.
It was my husband Jim and I just kind of sat there like stunned. So then, of course, the social media soccer sphere like completely erupts in pain, suffering, disgust,
anger,
all the stages of grief, right? So, but I think, and then, just interrupting myself here to say that all of the speculation had been going on and on about, you know, what's going to happen with U.S. soccer? Is U.S. soccer going to the World Cup? Is U.S. soccer ever going to, like, win a World Cup? U.S. soccer, and I'm like, the U.S. women's team has all kinds of championships. You keep forgetting. And a lot of people would delete the original tweets and then put the qualifier in men's soccer. So I appreciated that. Because, you know, while U.S. women's national team and soccer has its own set of issues, we're not talking about them today. And they have managed to get themselves to the World Cup, you know, well deep into the Olympics, Olympics, et cetera. So, and they seem to be trying a lot of new things with a lot of young players. And so that's cool. Men's national team. And I would say U.S. soccer, both men's and women's, is really dependent on, I think, and you guys feel free to chime in, is development and how the sport is treated in this country and how players are developed and how clubs have development teams, what age they start. But to me, it goes all the way down into like park district and young kids getting started playing the game. But then how kids with talent are pipelined into certain places. We can talk about accessibility of club soccer and elite soccer and all that other stuff another time. But like we need more kids playing soccer. We need soccer to be more important, and we need the development to be smart. And right now, So Bruce Arena resigned. I'm air quoting.
He resigned. Maybe just a little bit of pressure there.
Might have been some pressure there. He had taken over the team after previously coaching the team. So he came back after
Klinsmann.
I want to call him Jurgen Klopp, and that's not his name. That's Liverpool's coach. Klinsmann was fired. Arena came back. Everybody's like, okay, like, why are we throwing back? So they really need to start over with the coaching as well. And they also need to start over with the leadership in U.S. soccer, like their board and their president. All those
yeah,
people got to go.
The president, for now at least, is still in place.
He's, for now. But I think the board, I've read some tweets from people on their board who have made it clear that they think a change needs to happen there as well. My thing is this. So I'm reading about who are being considered for replacements. Among them are the current United States U-20 coach, the guy who coached France for a few years after the World Cup in 2010.
Nice outfits, at least.
Oh, that guy is, like, sartorially speaking, one of the – his name is Laurent Blanc. And you can tell from his glasses that he's going to be an amazing coach. But my question is, if you're going to do this reboot of American soccer, is now the time to bring in somebody who maybe is not as familiar with United States soccer culture and the development that has to happen? Or are you just bringing in somebody to fix the team? And are you going to have your national teams be sort of this separate thing from the whole development programs? To me, it's all of a piece.
Yeah.
You know, at least in my admittedly extremely limited knowledge of how this all works. But it seems to me like it's all of a piece. If you really are going to burn it all to the ground and start over, then you need new coaches. It'd be great to have people who are very familiar with American soccer culture. It would be great to add some more diversity into the mix, different perspectives, and do it that way. Because as the U.S. men's national team goes, sadly, so goes everything else soccer in this country. MLS soccer, the National Women's Soccer League, college soccer, all of it. I mean, people are going to look to that coach and that group to sort of fuel the interest in soccer in this country. So, yeah, it totally sucks because the United States going to the World Cup next year was going to be hitting at a time that interest in soccer is starting to peak. Mm-hmm. And people are getting really interested. And Christian Pulisic is like he's like expected to save the team. He just turned 19 years old in September. He's a great player. He's going to get better. But you can't just hang your hat on that. And this was the time for them to really go to the World Cup and do something there. And that's going to set soccer back 5 years easily, I think.
Yeah.
Men's soccer.
Wouldn't a superstar, isn't that kind of a superstar almost what, you know, men's soccer especially needs? There's been a lot of superstars in women's U.S. soccer.
But, oh, yeah.
I mean, Landon Donovan was great, but I mean, he never really reached that
status. Well, that's exactly what the team needs. But the problem is now that exactly when the team has someone who could become that, they're not going to be on the world stage.
Oh, yeah.
So that's kind of the catch-22. You've got someone in Pulisic who can be that player, but now he's not going to be on the big world stage for another 4 years.
Exactly.
Maybe he should move to a different country and get some.
Oh, I was just wondering, you know, there's a picture of him with his, like, jersey over his head and, like, because, you know, he's a kid, he's 19, he's playing over in Europe in the Bundesliga, he's a great player, but, like, you want to play in the World Cup for your country's team, and he doesn't get to go, and I was wondering if he's going to just, like, suddenly move to Argentina or something like that, but yeah, the thing is in four more years after the World Cup, he'll be 25 years old. I mean, he will be physically peaking at that time or whatever, I don't even know what that means anymore, but it does set. I do think it sets our program back, and it just kind of sucks for him.
Yeah, and I think just from my perspective as someone who follows soccer some, but not that closely, it would seem logical to me that if you're going to really rebuild things from the ground up, now is the time to do it because you know you're not going to the World Cup next year anyway.
Right.
That would seem to be the time to take a couple of years and really reevaluate your whole entire program from the ground up and start building it, you know, quote, the right way, as opposed to just trying to put a Band-Aid on the national team and qualify for the next World Cup.
Well, exactly. And, you know, as somebody who is a fan of the MLS, who has grown to love it, I think it's pretty critical to build up the standing of MLS on the world soccer stage as well. I mean, that's where a lot of these players are coming from. Not all of them, not some of the some of the U.S. men's national team play on teams out in the world, but like a lot of them are homegrown. And like, you know, so But with the U.S. being out of the World Cup and suddenly sports journalism paying attention to soccer, after they got knocked out, that was more articles about U.S. soccer than I'd seen in a really long time. So now it's like totally bad PR, too. Like people are going to lose a little bit of interest. And MLS, their season is ending right now, too. So it's just a whole bunch of bad factors. Mm-hmm. I'm mad about it.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I would be, too. Meanwhile, big news in college basketball. We touched on this a little bit on our last episode. It was literally just breaking when we recorded our last episode. But more fallout from the arrests by the FBI of four NCAA assistant basketball coaches. The latest domino to fall there is that Louisville head coach Rick Pitino has actually been
officially
let go.
Fired.
Yeah,
yep.
Let go by the university's board of trustees. So it's a done deal.
From
although
the top.
There will be a lawsuit, I think he's going to sue for wrongful termination and, you know, $40-some million. But in terms of who's going to be on the sideline for Louisville this year, it will not be Rick Pitino.
It's going to be interesting to see where this all goes. Obviously, people are saying because the schools that have been, caught so far are all Adidas schools, and everyone says, oh, well, I'll just wait because the Nike schools are coming. It'd be interesting to see if that actually happens or if it just kind of goes under the bus like a lot of these things do after the initial burst of activity. Certainly, there's a lot of big names, and no way I'm going to speculate, but there's a lot of big names out there who could go down if they went after Nike schools. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Yeah, long way to go in this little saga. That's for sure.
Just figure out a way. I mean, this is what happens when you have, really, the NCAA works the way it does.
I have a question for you guys, though.
Yeah.
So I don't watch a lot of football anymore because of just general disgust with the NFL on many levels. Is this going to change the way you guys watch basketball, college basketball?
No.
Okay.
I mean,
I'm just curious.
This is the least surprising thing. I mean,
sure.
It's
a lot of stinky, dirty laundry.
Yeah, but there always is and always has been in college basketball. I think the only way to solve it is to pay them, but I don't have that solution either.
That's the end game. Yeah. That's the solution, but getting there is.
Yeah, making basically college basketball teams the minor leagues officially mm-hmm. of professional basketball teams.
We haven't talked about that for a long time, actually, because we talked about it a couple times before.
That's probably the only way to solve it. Otherwise, you have people who are going to be making millions and millions of dollars and institutions and coaches who stand to get millions and millions of dollars based on these people. I mean, it's going to be seedy. It's going to be, I just want the kids to play and have a level playing field, and I don't want them to get screwed.
Yeah, and honestly, it was going to take something like an FBI investigation really to get to the bottom of it, because the NCAA really just has very limited authority on what it can do. I mean, it can't subpoena people. It can't wiretap people. It can't do all these other things that law enforcement can do. So that honestly is what it was going to take to, catch anybody in the act of doing a lot of this stuff, at least, enough to make any difference.
Right. And this comes right on the heat. Well, right. Just a couple of days ago, the official investigation by the NCAA into the 2005 North Carolina Tar Heel basketball team, which people around here might remember as the team who defeated Illinois in the national championship game, just got off scot-free of a big scandal that everyone thought because of some questionable classes that were more or less probably made up for athletes. The scandal just that it petered out. So just another example of how the NCAA really has no muscle and also is probably unwilling to, especially if you're North Carolina or some major school like that, they're probably not going to make an example of you.
Yeah, that's right. And I think as I read a little bit about this, it sounded like, one, North Carolina had some really good lawyers. And two, it sounded like the NCAA did not want to start evaluating what constituted an actual quality academic class and what did not.
Because what kind of rabbit hole is that?
Yeah, it basically decided they did not want to go down the, quote, slippery slope mm-hmm. that would create. So they just punted on it. And so good old Roy and his Tar Heels still get the raise.
I think John's got the right idea.
Banner.
burn it down, pay them, have it be an NBA feeder system.
Yeah,
we can still enjoy
it. Affiliated with the university, but just make it a separate thing. Get, you know, a lot of people have suggested, you know, give them, if they don't necessarily take classes, then give them, like, access to a four-year degree for life. So, you know, if the career doesn't work out or they don't make the NBA like they expect, they can still come. So, but, you know, that's not going to happen anytime soon, but it needs to happen. Anyway, baseball.
Baseball. Lots of baseball talk still to come here on the bandwagon. Coming up, we'll talk with Michael Cerami from Bleacher Nation. We'll see what's going on with the Cubs as they're down in the National League Championship Series as we talk here today. That's coming up next on the bandwagon. Chicago Cubs find themselves down 2-0 in the National League Championship Series as we talk here on Tuesday. And here to talk about all things Cub with us is Michael Cerami, who writes for the Cubs website Bleacher Nation. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
Doing okay. We're hopefully we'll be feeling a little better in about 12 hours or so after the Cubs play Game 3. But I guess, Michael, to start off with, as you look at how this series has shaped up so far, not a whole lot really went right for the Cubs there in Los Angeles, did it?
No, pretty much all the things that went right for Los Angeles are going wrong for the Cubs, specifically the bullpen. They had a little bit better showing in Game 2, but still ultimately gave up the decisive home run. And the offense has really disappeared. And the Dodgers shown that, you know, they could keep grinding away. And, you know, they broke through in the ninth and they were able to take the game. The Cubs bats never got another chance in extras. So they're going to have to show a little bit more and because they can't just keep relying on their starting pitchers like they did in the first half of the NLDS when the top three guys were going 6-7 innings.
And, Michael, we'll get into some other things here, but I have to ask you about the decision in Game 2 to go with John Lackey there in the ninth inning with runners on base for L.A., you know, most important situation of the game, and you're relying on a 39-year-old starting pitcher who had never pitched relief in back-to-back outings before. What did you make of that decision by Joe Maddon?
Yeah, it was obviously one that's been second-guessed a lot, including by me. Unless there was some very specific reason Wade Davis wasn't pitching, and that could have been the 40 or so pitches he threw in Game 5, or one, and then it would make some sense. But after the game, Maddon came out and talked to the press and said they were holding Davis for the save, which is just the oldest of old school thinking. And it's not even something that Maddon usually subscribes to. We've seen him put Davis into those ninth inning tie game situations all season long. And he did it last year too with Hector Rondon and Aroldis Chapman. He understands that when the game is on the line, you need your best pitcher in because there's no 10th inning to save if you don't get there first. So even though he said he was holding Davis for the save, I mean, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist or Maddon apologist. I have to imagine there must have been some extenuating circumstance for why they wanted to give Davis another 2 days of rest, not pitching that day and the off day yesterday. Hopefully they can use him a lot over the next 3 days because that was a head scratcher. And yeah, not only is Lackey not a reliever, not only is he not pitched 2 days in a row, not only is he not a high strikeout guy, he's given up the most the highest home run rate in baseball this year. And with a guy on second and someone like Justin Turner up, I mean, it's just not the right pitcher for that circumstance, especially when you have Hector Rondon also sitting in the bullpen. So there must be more that we're not really seeing, but you know, given what he said after the game, it's pretty hard to justify because that saving your closer for a save spot is just not something that most new age managers like Joe Maddon tend to subscribe to.
Taking sort of a bigger picture approach on Joe Maddon, we're looking at obviously he's been there for 3 years and they've been in the LCS 3 years, and of course you just explained why, you know, this in-game decision was kind of brutal. And obviously Joe Girardi took the Yankees to the ALCS too, but got a lot of crap for a decision he made. Do you think that being a baseball manager in this day and age is next to impossible? I mean, Joe Maddon, how could the guy who took the Cubs to the World Series basically, even after the World Series with how he treated Chapman, get all kinds of crap. I mean, shouldn't he just say, I won the first World Series in 100 years, screw all you guys? Or
sure. I mean, so yeah, he's the NL Manager of the Year, World Series winning manager, the All-Star manager this year. He's very clearly a great manager all around. But as a lot of people say, his biggest strengths are sort of managing the clubhouse, managing the media, and playing for the regular season. He's always gotten a little bit of flack for his bullpen decisions. And unfortunately, it is a little bit of a lose-lose because, you know, let's say you have your baseball crowd split into a group of people that are traditional and more traditional stats-based and advanced stats-based. There's probably a good portion of people out there thinking Madden made the right call. And had he gone the other way and brought in Davis in his high game, and let's say Davis does close it out and they get to extras and then Lackey has to pitch and blows it, those guys would have been riding Madden for not saving his closer for the save spot. So it's a bit of a lose-lose. It just so happens that we now know, thanks to the new era of baseball that we live in, that the highest leverage moment matters no matter when, matters more no matter when it comes. And in that instance, Justin Turner with the game on the line was the highest leverage moment. So, yeah, maybe he would have gotten grief on either side, no matter which way he went, except for one of the grief would have been appropriately applied, and the other one was what we saw. So I sympathize. It is, of course, a hard position to be in, especially in such a high-profile stage like the Dodgers and Cubs in the NLCS. But at the same time, you have to make the same decisions that you've been making all year and trust the process, not hope for the best because you want to save your closer for an extra inning or for another day.
So Lisa here. So I will freely admit that I come to baseball in the postseason. I'm not a huge fan during the season. I don't slog it out with everybody for 162 games or something like that. So What it seems like to me compared with last year is it's not just Madden and how he's the perception of how he's managing the team right now, but sort of the team in general. It feels like a general sense of disarray. I feel like there's disarray with all the pitching decisions, and then you have Chris Bryant striking out like every time I turn the television on, he is striking out. This doesn't, and I realize that it's not all about one player, but I'm getting this general vibe of disarray, and I was wondering, A, if that is indeed the case, or if I'm just like come lately to what's going on with the Cubs, and B, what the feeling is like in Chicago among the fans and maybe some of the writers, just about compared with last year. Last year was such a special year, and now even with these two guys in the studio and here at the station, I something is different about this year coming from them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. To your first point about the team being in disarray, they went through five long games in the NLDS against the Nationals while the Dodgers only needed to play three to get past the Diamondbacks. They played an extraordinarily long, grueling, pitcher-heavy game five, then had to travel to Los Angeles where their travels were stopped and they had to divert because of Jose Quintana's wife. There was some medical concern that has since been cleared up, apparently. So they got in late. And then they're playing in an away ballpark against Clayton Kershaw without all of their pitchers healthy. You know, Jose Quintana was on short rest, having pitched in game four, and there was just a lot working against them. They had a bit of a breather then before game two, but again, the same problems persisted. They were still on the road, hadn't slept, had just come off of a long travel schedule, and again, their pitchers, John Lester, had just pitched in game five. So there's a lot going on around the team that wasn't necessarily on-field stuff that could sort of lead to that feeling of disarray. And I agree that, it's palpable. You could feel it. As for the individual players and the feeling around Chicago, I'd say, well, it's really hard for people to ride Chris Bryant because he's essentially one of the best Cubs players almost already in history. He's on his way, certainly. And he's one of the main reasons they even went to the NLCS any of these years, or the playoffs for that matter. It's a terrible time for him to slump, especially yes. The way he's slumping, because strikeouts, it's not even putting the ball in play. You could score a run at least with Zach Fly or whatever. So it's this weird balance of saying, can I get mad at Chris Bryant? Can I let myself say he's the reason we're not winning right now? Because a little bit, it is his fault. he's the guy the Cubs rely on more than anyone. But at the same time, the Cubs wouldn't have even been there if it weren't for him. So there's like a catch-22 when you're trying to be a fan or to analyze the team, because the best guys are not showing up, and it's hard to say, okay, John Jay is our best hitter right now. And it's like, well, I mean, it's not the guy you want to be your best hitter, even if it's great that he's hitting well.
Well, I do want to make it clear I wasn't, like, coming down hard on him. There was just one I actually texted both John and Brian after I saw him strike out swinging again. And the look on his face, I had such empathy for him.
Sure.
Because that, like you said, he's not putting the ball in play. He's not even getting the bat on the ball at all. It just, the look on his face, I just, you know, I'm a parent. I just wanted to pat him and be like, dude, it's okay. You'll come out of it. So, yeah, thanks for that.
No, definitely.
Yeah, and Michael, I guess that kind of comes to the question about the lineup and why it's struggling so much. Obviously, a part of that, and probably a large part of that, is the pitching that they're facing in LA. The Dodgers not only have good starting pitching that they've seen in Kershaw and Hill, but also a very good bullpen that's been lights out. But as the Cubs come back to Wrigley Field here for Game 3, what kinds of things do they need to do just to maybe have some better at-bats and at least make those Dodgers pitchers work a little more?
Well, first thing that is a little bit – that's been especially frustrating is the Cubs have actually knocked out the Dodgers starters early in the first two games, and that's actually been to their own demise. The Dodgers know that their bullpen has been lights out and it's well-rested. So they took Kershaw and Hill out in the fifth inning, after the fourth inning, rather, and that's been a big problem. So the Cubs need to get to the starting pitcher early, not just force them out of the game, but score runs early, because as soon as you get into that bullpen, things can get more troubling. On top of that, I'm somewhat expecting both Kyle Schwarber and Ian Happ to be in the lineup tonight as the Cubs sort of switch their, I don't want to say priority, but willingness to go for home runs right now, because they need to put runs on the board and they're not stringing hits together. So at a certain point, you need to turn to your power hitters and just let them, let it go a little bit. Fortunately, Yu Darvish, tonight's starter, has some pretty serious lefty-righty splits, which means that Schwarber and Happ, who is a switch hitter, will both benefit from that. He also lets up a lot of fly balls. Kyle Schwarber and Happ are both really good at hitting fly balls. And they'll be playing at home, so I think you might even see Javi Baez take a seat tonight, especially because of how tough Darvish is on righties, and you might see Happ at second and Schwarber in left. And again, that would be for the purpose of trying to get a little bit more power into the lineup and into the offense that's been mostly quiet up until this point.
Well, I'm hoping for Happ. I saw that article you wrote the other day about the offensive and where Happ has gone, and that's been kind of mysterious to me, especially not even in a pinch-hitting role. But to sort of take things into sort of a bigger question. We're sort of a media organization here, and just curious what it's like, if you could speak to in general, what it's like for you. I know Brett Taylor is his name, is the one who started Bleacher Nation, and you work in sort of a smaller, you're not quite a blog, but you're not the Chicago Tribune. How does that work for you sort of in a day-to-day environment? Are you able to get the access you need? How do you split time between obviously being a fan, which, I know Brian and I appreciate the fan aspect of the site and your writing versus, taking a sort of bigger picture, this is what's actually happening approach?
Sure. And yeah, we definitely think of ourselves as fans first and also consider that arguably our biggest strength as a site, because we try to write not just personally and personably in ways that people can relate to, but in a way that frames stories or news the way fans want to hear it. We try to say not just this is what happened, but this is what happened and here's how you should feel about it. Or it's okay to be mad. It's okay to be frustrated. Or here's a reason for optimism. Here's something to look out for. It's not just the stats or the news. We try to really make it more of a community. And it sounds cliche, but it does elicit a little bit of a different style of writing. And it's nice to sort of connect with people in their own lingo, and while sort of, quietly or intermittently dashing in things like advanced stats and analytics. We don't have, as you said, we don't have the access of the Tribune or the Sun-Times, But we make it work in other ways, and we get quotes from other sources, and we find a way to sort of bridge that gap between traditional media and, you know, just sending off a tweet every now and then. And it's kind of right in that middle space that we found our little niche and operate as a blog for Cubs fans and, like, you know, also by Cubs fans. That's what we were first. I started as a reader of Bleacher Nation long before I was ever hired, and a lot of the education about the Cubs I have now and knowledge was all because of Brett, who founded the site originally. So I definitely valued it a lot. It was the perfect way to get into baseball back in the mid-2000s, and it's grown so much since. And I think, again, it's because we talk to fans like they're fans, like we're fans, and try to use the same, try to target the feelings or emotions they might be having in that moment. We don't shy away from that. When things are bad, they're bad, and it's okay to say that they're bad so long as you know why they're bad and how they might get better. So it's really just bridging the gap between analyzing things and it's still enjoying the other side of baseball, which is just enjoying the game, just being a fan.
And I have just one last question for you before we go here, and that is, as someone who's followed both of you and Brett on Twitter for years, I know that Brett's been trying to get the Bleacher Nation site verified forever, and I noticed that you recently got verified, and that irked him quite a bit. How did that make you feel? Did that make you feel proud?
We're talking about Twitter, of course.
The blue
yeah.
check, right?
Yeah,
that's
the blue
what we're
check.
Talking about? Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty much the best day of my life when I woke up. I woke up to a text from Brett, like, just grumbling, laughing, of course. I mean, he's very happy that I got verified. It's good for us in general. It is pretty, you know, it's a head-scratcher as to why the site I write for can't get verified when I can get verified as a writer for that site and specifically on those merits. But it's become sort of just like a funny inside joke with a lot of the commenters on our site and people that follow us on Twitter. I'll tweet something or Brett will tweet something and the people will respond like, I don't know if I can trust you. You don't have the blue check mark. Get asked Michael Cerami for it. It's like, you know, this is my boss and knows 10 times more about the Cubs than I do and how all of this works. And yet, you know, we have this funny little joke. I'm sure he'll get it soon enough. And, I mean, there's no one more deserving, so I would definitely look for that soon.
That's Michael Cerami from BleacherNation.com. Of course, the website at BleacherNation.com. You can also follow Michael on Twitter and Brett on Twitter as well, even though he's not verified.
Yeah, but I think he's probably fairly trustworthy.
Yeah, we'll put those links in our show notes today as well. Michael Cerami from Bleacher Nation, thanks a lot for joining us, and go Cubs, go.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thanks again to Michael Cerami from Bleacher Nation for joining us today to talk a little Cubs baseball here in October. That's always nice to say, Cubs baseball in October. Time now for our newest regular segment, Controversy. John Steinbacher, you're up this week. What do you have?
Well, sticking with baseball, we're going to talk about corked bats.
Corked bats.
Of course, if we're talking about the Cubs, the most famous example would be on June 3rd, 2003, when one Sammy Sosa was up to bat. He hit the ball down to the third baseman or shortstop. I don't know.
Yeah, it was on the infield, it wasn't.
Yes. Yeah, and his bat split in half, went flying, and then immediately you could see Sammy like sort of looking over at the bat. Something seemed odd. Then the umpire looked at it and noticed that it didn't look like a regular bat. The camera went in close and it was like, uh-oh. So basically, he had corked his bat, and the idea of behind corking your bat is it's lighter and supposedly bouncier of a substance than like
wood,
and that you would get better bat speed and there would be, you know, more of a
almost a trampoline effect.
A trampoline effect on the bat, which, you know, I'll talk about later, probably is not even really the case. So Sammy Sosa, it was a big controversy. He got suspended for 8 games, and, you know, after that incident, sort of, I think not too much longer, he, like, hurt his back sneezing or something and was really done that. That was pretty much the end of his like career as like a superstar. You know, mega. He played for the Cubs maybe for another year.
Another year. Oh, four was the last one. Yeah.
Just was never the same after that, and I'm not saying the cork bag was the problem, but that is not the most, in my opinion, the most interesting cork bag incident. That would be Albert Bell, been playing for the Cleveland Indians on July 15th, 1994. The White Sox accused Albert Bell of having a corked bat, so apparently the umpires took one of the bats and locked it in a room, one of Albert Bell's bats to lock in a room to check later after the game. The Indians got word of that, and then they sent what is his name? Grimsley?
Jason Grimsley?
Yes, Jason Grimsley to retrieve the bat. He accessed the area above a false ceiling in the clubhouse and crawled across with a flashlight in his mouth until he reached the umpire's room. He switched Albert Bell's bat with Paul Sorrento. And then during the sixth inning, Paul Sorrento's bat. During the sixth inning, the umpire's custodian noticed clumps of ceiling tile on the floor in the umpire room, plus twisted metal brackets in the ceiling. After the game, Phillips noticed the bats were different when he saw that the replacement was not as shiny and was also stamped with Sorrento's signature, which is sort of a giveaway. So but my favorite part about it is I think they were initially going to just replace it with one of Albert Bell's bats, but all of his bats were corked. So, they didn't even have, like, a dummy bat to take in there. Grimsley apparently kept his partition secret until 1999, and the story was corroborated by Indian shortstop Omar Vasquez in a 2002 book where he confirmed that all of Bell's bats were corked. Now, the interesting thing about that is Sammy Sosa claimed that he used the wrong bat, that this was his batting practice bat that he liked to put on a show for the fans, and that's why he had a corked bat. And actually, they looked at all of his other bats, and none of them were corked. They even took a couple from the Hall of Fame, apparently.
Wow.
That, you know, because of his 1998 year where him and Mark McGwire, totally on the level, having nothing to do with all the amounts of steroids and everything else they were ingesting, won.
Androstenedione.
Yeah, so there hasn't been a corked bat controversy in quite a while. It seemed like for a while there, every couple of years, and I think that was according to this, in 2007 season of the show MythBusters, they reviewed it and found that actually corking your bat was detrimental to the bat's performance.
Ooh.
So here are some of the people: Billy Hatcher. He claimed he got 10 games suspension. He claimed he borrowed the bat from a pitcher. Albert Bell just did not have an excuse, which I appreciate. Chris Sabo said he borrowed it from an unnamed teammate.
Unnamed. Course,
yeah, I borrowed it from someone. I don't know whose bat it was. And then my favorite is Greg Nettles, who was playing for the Yankees in 1974. He, I think, was kind of the first person to get kind of caught for this, but his was not corked with cork. It was corked with six Super Balls, which is kind of fun.
Yes.
And his excuse was, oh, a fan gave me the ball bat.
Super Balls, like with the rubber?
Yeah, the hard rubber.
Super bouncy balls?
Yeah.
As if in a Major League Baseball
Greg
player would just be getting...
Greg Nettles did that?
Yeah, would just be like, oh, thanks for the bat. I'll just use this.
sure. Hey, back in the 70s, anything went, right?
I mean, oh, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Use whatever. Use a stick.
and then, famously, in, I guess, 2010, but Deadspin has reported that Pete Rose used cork bats when he was trying to break Ty Cobb's all-time record. And two sports memorabilia collectors who owned Rose's game-used bats from that season had the bats x-rayed and found telltale signs of corking.
Oh.
So I know this is going to come as a shock to everyone that Pete Rose, the most upstanding baseball player of all time.
Pete Rose would never cheat in any way.
Fake
shape
news,
or form.
John.
But I mean, I think it's really interesting that they have done this for all this long, and it probably doesn't really help. You're trying to do anything you can, but... And we talked off air about, this isn't the only, bat incident in baseball. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Pine Tar with
George Brett.
George Brett is a
I'll never
is
forget
a classic,
that photo.
Crazy George Brett running from the dugout.
Oh, man. I'm going to find that picture and look at it right now.
That's great.
But, baseball players will do whatever they can, and most athletes will, to get that extra advantage, even corking their bats. But I don't know. I wonder if something's happening with bats these days. I would hope it's not corking, since it's probably not helping, but something.
Something. Something's going on.
Yeah.
We'll see what it is. All right, John, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John.
That's our controversy for this week. All right, kids, status update time. You want to go?
I'll go, because it just happened.
Oh,
like,
hey.
Since we've been on the air, sort of, kind of.
Yeah.
Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
So that's, I'm setting the stage. It's a nice sunny day in Brooklyn, New York. A rogue cow ran through parts of South Brooklyn on Tuesday afternoon and has been corralled inside of a soccer field in Prospect Park, where officers are trying and failing to wrangle it into custody. It is unclear how or from where the cow got loose, but Brooklynites reported seeing the cow at various locations around the Southwest Prospect Park area before noon. So the original picture that I saw, like just a little bit earlier here in the podcast, as I was scrolling through our Twitter feed, I noticed that there was a cow on a soccer field, and I had to investigate. And that's my status update.
Is the cow trying out for the men's national team?
You know, it could be an improvement, although he or she looks a little on the skinny side.
Oh, okay.
So, all right. But is refusing capture. So wow. Tenacious. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Good
anyway.
Energy.
Yeah. Great energy.
All right. I'll go next. This is something that just came out in the last day or so, too. Apparently, there is, quote, growing consensus, according to Tracy Ringlesby of Baseball America, that in baseball, that expansion and division realignment are going to happen. The likely expansion cities seem to be Montreal, which would be replacing the Expos, who left there, I think, in 2005, and Portland, Oregon, rapidly growing city on the West Coast. So that would be the other choice for an expansion city. Now, the realignment part gets a little bit interesting. They would essentially get rid of the separate leagues, American and National. Everything would be all under one, just Major League Baseball. Four divisions of eight teams each, East, North, Midwest, and West. The playoffs would get weird. You'd have your division champs, which would advance to the division series round. But then there's a whole lot of play-in games to get to the division series round. I won't get into all the details there. We'll link to it. The other change would that the schedule would go back to 156 games, so six fewer regular season games, but they would take essentially the same amount of time to play those games. Some of the pluses to this for teams, there would be less travel. There would be the divisions would almost all be single time zone divisions, so you'd have less long flights. You would play all a bunch of games against teams in your division and only three games against every other team in the league each season. Just for an example, your divisions, the Midwest division would supposedly include both Chicago teams, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Detroit, Cleveland, kind of the usual suspect.
Twins.
There. Actually, the Twins, under this scenario, would be they would be put in this North division with mostly Eastern time zone teams under this little scenario. So I don't know how realistic all of this is. It would certainly be interesting. It would be interesting. I don't know how feasible this is, when this would happen. The realignment part of this, I think, is probably the less likely of things to happen, at least how it's outlined here, because it's such a radical change from what there is now. But, hey, I could dig baseball coming back to Montreal and a team in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, it's interesting. They were, you know, contracting a few years ago, and then it was a while ago now. But
almost 20 now, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know.
We'll see what happens. All right, so that's my status updates. Mr. Steinbacher?
Just real quick here, going back to soccer, I noticed that Columbus, Ohio has a very strong soccer team.
The Crew.
Big fan base. Little known fact, Columbus, Ohio, second largest city in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. behind Chicago. Yeah. It's really grown a lot.
And so does Cincinnati. They have a lower tier league, but they get 30,000 people at their games routinely.
But anyway. It's back to the same old thing. The owner's going to move the team to Austin, also a rapidly growing city, because he's not getting the stadium deal he wants, and he's threatening that starting today. So.
But isn't their stadium not even that old in Columbus?
It doesn't
I think
matter.
It was built, 20 years ago?
Yeah, but, who cares? Just build us a new stadium, or else we're going elsewhere.
You and the taxpayers pay for my new stadium, or I'll go somewhere that will pay for my new stadium.
That's right. Well, Ohio State's there, so I don't have to worry about it. Isn't that why there's no professional sports there?
Yeah, except for hockey. Right. Yeah.
Where are they going to build a stadium in Austin? There's
that
like
I don't
no,
know.
There's like nowhere to build it.
Probably San Antonio.
Yeah, out 30 minutes outside of the city somewhere. Yeah. I mean, Austin's growing so fast.
Same thing with Columbus. Yeah, they're basically now just giant suburbs with cities in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Mm. Anyway,
so that I think is going to wrap things up for today's episode. But first, we have credits.
Yes, we have credits. Of course, three of us would like to thank all of you for joining us on the bandwagon today. This episode was produced by Brian Moline, John Steinbacher, and Lisa Braltz. That's me. These days, Bandwagon is supported by several of our friends and colleagues, including, but not limited to, Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman. And our friends Automatic Empire, who wrote and performed our theme music and some of the other interstitial music you may or may not have heard, depending on Brian's mood. Find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. We link to almost everything we discuss here on the podcast. You can also subscribe to us and rate us, not us, but our podcast, in iTunes. Rating us will help us be discovered by people.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we love that. But you can really find us pretty much anywhere that you get your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants, no vowels, to get our most recent thoughts on all things sports and culture, and occasionally other topics. This cow is still on the soccer field, by the way. We all have our own Twitter accounts. You can find those handles at the main Bandwagon account and follow us. Feel free to call our attention to whatever sports-related thing you desire. We'll be back in a couple of weeks for yet another episode about the sometimes, nay, almost always, strange intersections between sports and everything else under the sun. Until then, thanks for playing.